Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Breaking news. A new CNN poll reveals significant challenges for President Biden. How he stacks up against Trump. The latest numbers, moments away. Plus, under oath.
We sit here day after day after day.
Trump's delay tactics appear to pay off as hush money allegations roil the race.
I'd always prefer somebody that didn't have an extramarital affair.
And new reporting on how the GOP plans to target red state Democrats. Plus, boiling point.
Why are you doing this?
As college campuses reel, Republicans pounce.
Go back to class and stop the nonsense.
How will Biden handle the fallout?
This is not about politics. It's about doing what's right.
And presidential punchlines.
Donald's had a few tough days lately. You might call it stormy weather.
Celebrities and journalists gather in Washington to roast and be roasted.
Like many of you here tonight, I pretend to do news on TV.
Inside Politics, best reporting from inside the corridors of power, starts now.
Welcome to Inside Politics Sunday. I'm Manu Raju, and we begin with breaking news. A new CNN national poll released for the first time here on Inside Politics Sunday reveals the challenges President Biden faces as he asks voters for a second term, even as former President Trump has been stuck in a New York courtroom fending off criminal charges and with three other criminal cases looming. Our new poll, which was conducted by SSRS, finds Trump is leading Biden, who has ample work to do with his base and with independent voters who are breaking to his GOP rival. In a head-to-head race, 49% of voters say they'd pick Trump for president, compared to 43% for Biden. That's a 9-point Trump advantage with independent voters. And add in third-party candidates, and Trump's lead jumps even more. He has 42% to Biden's 33%, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. gets 16% of the vote. Our poll also underscores the challenges of incumbency, and that voters, 4 years later, have a better view of Trump's presidency compared to Biden's. 55% say Trump's time in office was a success, with only 39% saying the same about Biden's presidency. And look at party breakdown. More people are calling Trump's presidency a success than in January of 2021. And that was in the wake of the Capitol attack by a mob of Trump supporters. The number of independents there going up by 7%. Now, Biden's team believes the numbers will change when voters begin to zero in more on the two candidates, a contrast he was more than eager to highlight at last night's White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Donald's had a few tough days lately. You might call it stormy weather. What the hell? Trump's so desperate he started reading those Bibles he's selling. Then he got to the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. That's when he put it down and said, this book's not for me.
All right, there's a lot to unpack. We've got a great panel to break this all down this morning. CNN's Caitlin Collins, Ested Herndon with The New York Times, and Sabrina Siddiqui with The Wall Street Journal. Good morning. It was a late night for a lot of us, but it's glad that you guys are all here.
And we're all here.
And we're all here. Let's break down some of the numbers, because as we were pouring through this, one thing really stood out to me is really just the problems that Biden has with his base and really the problems of being an incumbent and facing the fact that voters are judging him on his record, may view Trump's presidency a little different after the last 4 years. But this is as we dive a little deeper in here about the problems with Biden and his base. Democrats, 56% of Democratic voters are dissatisfied with the presidential candidate status. You look at party breakdown. That is different than Republicans. 63% of Republicans are satisfied, just 37% dissatisfied. That's the base issue. And then you talk about the number of Democrats versus Republicans, how they view the Biden versus Trump presidency. 73% of Democrats view that Biden's presidency has been a success. Sure, I guess that sounds good. But then you compare that to Trump's presidency. More Republicans view Trump's presidency is a success. It really highlights the dual challenges that Biden faces as he heads into November.
I'm so glad you pulled this out, because I was looking through this poll. That's also what stood out to me, is that essentially it's which party is more united behind their candidate. And when you look at these numbers, Democrats view Biden worse than Republicans view Trump, which I don't think is a surprise when you listen to what Republicans who have been saying they stand behind Donald Trump when it comes to almost anything. But the question is, you know, how does that hurt Biden's momentum going into November? What does that look like out on the campaign trail? I do think part of it is Biden's in office right now, and it's easier to judge someone who is president at this time. I think people always have a fonder look at a past president and how his presidency went, because, you know, whether Biden's or whether Trump's presidency was a success and how people are viewing that now is quite high. When you look at what the poll was right after January 6th, truly like days before Trump left office, it was much worse of an evaluation. So it also makes me think of, you know, what's being trotted out, what's in the public domain, what are we talking about? Trump's trial, all related to trying to overturn the election, is likely not going to go to trial before the election. How does that affect what voters are thinking of?
Yeah, and how does that affect the Biden's campaign strategy to try to remind voters about what happened in the Trump years, remind people about January 6th, remind people about, you know, those independent voters who are going to be so critical here. But, you know, when you ask voters in this poll about the issues that are important to them, they say that the economy, which tends to dominate every single national election, 65%, protecting democracy, high up there is a big theme of the Biden campaign, in particular immigration and crime right up there, as well as other issues too, as gun policy, healthcare, and abortion. 42% of voters view that is the most important issue for them. But this is the challenge for Biden, because then when you ask about how is he handling these big issues, he's underwater on all these main issues. And that is obviously one thing that's driving his challenges here. And one of the things, too, of course, is the economy, as we drill down even further. Inflation is still, sure, it's getting better, but people are still concerned about it. Just 29% of voters approve of his handling of inflation. That has not changed, really, since last year.
Yeah, and I think that encapsulates some of these base enthusiasm problems. I just got back from Wisconsin. We were on a reporting trip. We were out at a Walmart, actually, which is shutting down. And we were talking to people just about their sense of the economy and who they kind of blame for this economic malaise, as we were kind of hearing around it. And a lot of it was a sense that prices are higher, and that kind of tangible impact on folks' pocketbooks mattered a lot more than the job increases that we have seen, that have even trickled down in places like Wisconsin. And so when you're in these kind of battleground states, where in places like Milwaukee, there is, what, 7, 8, 10 out of 10 folks are Democrats, the question is about motivation, really. But that is really tampering that down, because people don't feel as if they've seen a real tangible benefit on the issue that matters most when we come to this. But I think that the attention gap is a really important thing here, because oftentimes when we look at these polls, Biden will do better among people who are most enthusiastic, most likely to vote. But when you expand the electorate out, that's where Trump actually does the best, too. And so Biden's hope is that as that information gets out there, as they are able to target those messages, some of these people come back around. The issue is, I think some of that attention gap might persist further and further through this year as people are tuning this out. Republicans had an active primary effort, right? They renominated Trump more actively than Democrats did. And I think for a lot of Democrats, there is a sense that this was kind of a coordinated thing that they has kind of been forced upon them. And they have tuned some of that out. At least that's what we hear on the road.
You know, we also think about what has dominated the headlines over the last 6 months, and that is the Israel-Hamas war, which may not rank high as a priority for voters when you look at the issues that you were just pointing to. That has been one of the key challenges for President Biden when you're talking about frustration coming from the Democratic base. It's not just coming from Muslim and Arab American voters. It's coming from Black voters. It's coming from young voters. It's coming from the exact constituencies that he needs to turn out to help propel him to a second term. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're talking about the coalition that he assembled, it was strong in 2020. It was strong turnout from the base, and it was those independents, those suburban voters who swung from Trump to Biden. And so what is striking is also those numbers that you see with independents now trending more toward former President Trump. And, you know, the Biden campaign does say, look, it's early.
Yeah.
You know, more people, they say, tend to tune in as the conventions unfold, when you get closer to the election. But one counterpoint to that is that we're not talking about, you know, an unknown presidential contest here. It's a rematch of 4 years ago. So, you know, some views of these two, you know, former president and incumbent president are very much baked in. Yeah. People already know what they need to know. So it's really just now on President Biden and his campaign to focus on the legislative accomplishments of the last 4 years and what he would do in a second term.
And you're talking about the contrast, and that's clearly what Joe Biden wants to paint, wants voters to focus on, not necessarily everything that happened in the last 4 years, but perhaps what happened in the last 8 years. And he took some jabs at his GOP rival at last night's White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Sleepy Don. I kind of like that. I may use that again. Age is an issue. I'm a grown man running against a six-year-old. Age is the only thing we have in common. My vice president actually endorses me. Did you hear what Donald just said about the major Civil War battle? Quote, Gettysburg, wow. Trump's speech was so embarrassing, the statue of Robert E. Lee surrendered again.
But, you know, last night was a joke, but that's actually kind of the strategy here. They want to get under Donald Trump's skin.
Oh, Biden always uses these dinners to do that. You know, he knows anytime, I mean, it's a room full of reporters. He does the same with these other Washington dinners. And obviously he is joking. It's not a surprise that he would take shots at Trump, but he is certainly going after him in a way that he thinks is effective, especially with the age issue, where he was tackling that, saying age is going to be an issue. You know, I'm a grown man and I'm running against a six-year-old. That is kind of how they're trying to frame it. And I should note, some people from Trump's campaign were in the room as these comments were being made. I didn't see them laughing at this. But I do think it speaks to, you know, what this dynamic is going to look like and how Biden is choosing to go after Trump. The Stormy Daniels comment was interesting to me. Yes, it's a joke, but the Biden campaign has taken basically a vow of silence on the Trump trial that is underway right now in Manhattan. And so it is interesting to see him kind of allude to it in a certain way, because obviously Trump has been trying to claim that Biden is leading these investigations.
Yes.
It's obviously not. It's through the Manhattan District Attorney's Office.
Yes, it would have been surprising if he did not say something about Stormy Daniels, even though he's been silent. This seemed to be a perfect opportunity to take a jab at him here. But let's just zoom out about the presidential campaign, because as Trump is in the courtroom right now, what Biden's campaign is doing, they're spending a ton of money on air, trying to take advantage of this moment where Donald Trump does not have as much money in his campaign account as Democrats do. $29 million compared to $11 million. That's just on presidential campaign spending in the last month and a half or so. And then when you get down to Biden's versus Trump's challenges, this is not, yes, Biden has problems with these polls, but Trump has problems with his polls too in some of these key areas. You look at the breakdown between college grad and non-college grad in this CNN's poll. Biden, this has been consistent all along about how Biden has an advantage with college graduates. But then you zoom in even further about the results, how voters are voting in these primary states, particularly in those suburban areas with some of the more educated voters. Haley's primary, this is Nikki Haley, his rival. She dropped out of this race 16% in this last week's Pennsylvania primary, including in many suburban areas, still voted for Nikki Haley. So look, Donald Trump has a problem, too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is interesting because these two candidates have problems that aren't really fixed by each other, right? Donald Trump's the impact of Donald Trump in these trials should not be minimized. I think for some reason there's a sense that they haven't actually hurt him, but they've actually been baked into his unpopularity for years now. He struggles with these independents. He struggles with these moderates, and that's cost him the last election, and it very well could cost him the next election. It is only such that because Biden has these kind of base problems, it is allowing him to steal a further polling lead. But also, Trump's problems have been in money and organization. The impacts of these trials have stopped the RNC from really building out a campaign or organization. And when you look at Biden's possibilities, there are issues down ballot that they think they can still propel them. Mm-hmm. We think about the abortion referendum in Nebraska or in Arizona, or new possibilities in Wisconsin. There could be a reason that the bottom of the ticket fuels Biden at the top, even though that lack of enthusiasm is certainly a maintaining storyline.
Very interesting. And that teases actually another segment later in the show when we'll be talking about down ticket issues. And we're going to be talking about next, inside the courtroom. 1 week down of testimony in Trump's criminal hush money case. Have prosecutors yet proven that Trump acted illegally? Our legal panel is here next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. quiets their snores, Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. Okay, by now you have probably heard that rappers Kendrick Lamar and Drake went after each other in a once-in-a-generation rap battle. By the time algorithms were done, the Kendrick-Drake beef had reached far beyond the walls of hip-hop. What can we learn from the first great rap battle of the streaming age? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
This past week might have been one of the most momentous when it comes to Donald Trump's legal problems. He spent 4 days in a New York courtroom in the first ever criminal case for an ex-president. The Supreme Court heard arguments in Trump's push to claim broad immunity and effectively derail two of his federal criminal cases. Also, a federal judge upheld the verdict in a case ordering Trump to pay $83.3 million to E. Jean Carroll after defaming her over sexual assault allegations. Now, on top of all that, a grand jury in Arizona indicted 11 of Trump's allies over their alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election results, where Trump was named as an unindicted co-conspirator. And he was also named as an unindicted co-conspirator in a similar fake elector scheme alleged in Michigan. So to help us unpack all this in this very important week, I'm joined again by CNN's Caitlin Collins and CNN's legal analyst Elliot Williams. Elliot, thanks for joining us for this discussion. So just, you know, there's so much that happened this past week. You were on air a lot. I saw a lot of you on CNN. But there were several takeaways just so viewers have a sense on some of the issues that people that happened over the past week. David Pecker, of course, who was testifying about the National Enquirer scheme to help Donald Trump in 2016, talked about that so-called catch-and-kill arrangement. There was Donald Trump's assistant talking about seeing Stormy Daniels at Trump Tower before Trump ran for president. There was discussions about the bank arrangements for Trump's so-called fixer at the time, Michael Cohen. So, but the question here, Elliot, I have to you is, have prosecutors made the case that a crime was actually committed?
They haven't made a case that a crime was actually committed, but they did what they needed to do in this first week of the trial. What they had to do was at least bring the jury in and start establishing the parameters of the crime that they're alleging. And the bigger thing and the bigger point for prosecutors is that there were no unforced errors. There's no witness that came up and said something that people didn't anticipate. There was no witness that got eviscerated on cross-examination. So I think prosecutors are happy with how the week went, but trials are long and it's not over yet.
Yeah, and but there's also a difference about what's happening in the courtroom and what's happening in the court of public opinion. Our new CNN poll talks about how 68% of voters nationally view Trump's treatment as more lenient and more harsh than other defendants, basically saying that it is not the same as other defendants. That's how public opinion, they're viewing this is a little bit different than typical cases. How did Trump's lawyers, you talked to Trump's lawyers, Caitlin, how did they view what has happened in court so far?
Well, they completely disagree with how the judge has been handling this. And they are in a position of defending Trump when he's pretty clearly violating the gag order. I mean, that has really been one of the biggest takeaways of how this is affecting Trump outside of the court, because he's continued to attack the witnesses in this case. He's commented on the jury itself, which is not allowed. Obviously, we saw weeks ago when he was going after the judge's daughter herself. And so that has kind of been the big question of how the judge is going to handle that. We may get an answer this week. He held a hearing last week, and some judges, former judges, retired judges, had speculated that he was writing it, you know, last week in the evenings. We never saw the decision there. They have another hearing on other violations. And Trump was talking about Michael Cohen in an interview that he recorded on his way to his gag order hearing about whether or not he had violated it by talking about Michael Cohen. Yeah. I mean, his disregard for it is pretty obvious. And we saw how Trump's attorney, you know, struggled to defend it. But I think big picture, the campaign and how they're looking at this. I mean, look at what Bill Barr told me the other night. Mm-hmm. He is one of the biggest Donald Trump critics. He watched him as he was trying to overturn the election results and left the White House in the middle of that. yet he is still voting for Donald Trump come November. And I think it just kind of speaks to the climate that we're in. The question is how pervasive that is.
Yeah, and you mentioned how Trump is making things difficult for his attorneys on the gag order. The New York Times had a report this weekend about whether it's affecting his legal strategy as well. This says this in this report. Others might concede personal failings so their lawyers can focus solely on holes in the prosecution's evidence. On television, it's often that version of, my client might not be a nice guy, but he's no criminal. But that time-honored tactic is not available to a defendant who is also the presumptive Republican nominee, a man who despises weakness and is allergic to anything but praise from people around him. So is Trump's demeanor hamstringing his attorneys in any way?
His demeanor hamstrings his attorneys when he speaks publicly. And I wonder the extent to which they've gotten in his head each night saying you have to stop the press conferences. It's one thing to be a candidate who is on trial. You know, it's a political process, and of course he's going to go out and bash Joe Biden and so on. But you can't do that in a courtroom. You can be subject to the rules of the court. But moreover, you can start getting in the jury's head and damaging your own chances of getting off at this trial. And so it's really, I would love to be a fly on the wall in those conversations with his attorneys, because I just think different candidates are difficult in different ways. And I can imagine he's probably
at some. And that is 100% true. The question is, how does it affect what happens with the case? Because they believe that kind of this case is a foregone conclusion. Mm-hmm. They don't even know that an acquittal, it seems completely far-fetched to them. They're hoping for a hung jury. They're hoping to appeal to that one juror who can, you know, understand that, you know, what they've been arguing, which is the merits of the case don't even make sense. That is really what they have been honing in on. How that looks and how that shapes out, as you know, you mentioned who's been on the stand. Mm-hmm. David Pecker, who's spoken favorably of Donald Trump as a human. Rona Graff also spoke very favorably of Donald Trump. And now it's a banker who's kind of going through statements. How does Trump react when it's Hope Hicks, when it's Stormy Daniels, when it's Karen McDougal, when it's obviously Michael Cohen?
Right.
How does that project in the courtroom? That's a big question.
And if there's a gag order ruling, we'll see how he reacts to that as well. I'm eager to get your opinion on this immunity case that happened before the Supreme Court. The arguments happened there. There's a question about, you know, John Roberts, of course, he'll be so central in all of this. Our colleague Joan Piscupa had some good reporting about John Roberts, who really didn't speak much in that roughly 3 hours of arguments. I'm curious, you observe these arguments. How does he steer this? Do you think that any of these trials beyond the hush money case will come to verdict before November?
I have a hard time seeing how any become to verdict before November, just based on where they all are in the process, including this one that's all the way up at the Supreme Court. The challenge for John Roberts is Donald Trump will lose in front of the Supreme Court. There will not be five justices in support of his position. However, in practice, it's a win, because ultimately his trial will be delayed in all likelihood until after November. The Supreme Court has this lofty intellectual vision about the institution that, well, we just ruled on the facts and the law and a party won. Well, we don't live in fantasy lawyer land in this world, and there are real consequences when the Supreme Court takes its time, and it will giving Donald Trump what he wants in practice, even if it's a legal loss.
Exactly, and polls do show that voters view those other three cases more seriously than the hush money case, or at least believe that it could disqualify him from the presidency, as you see there from the CNN poll as well. That's one reason why he wants to delay those, and maybe he'll be successful. All right, coming up for us, campus protests are reaching a breaking point. More CNN new poll results on the political fallout. College campuses are once again a hotbed of anti-war sentiment, this time pro-Palestinian protests with young Americans' anger over Gaza boiling over. Arrests, some violence, and charges of anti-Semitism have marred what have often been peaceful demonstrations of discontent over Israel's actions in Gaza and the United States' approach to the conflict. And new polling this hour from CNN that shows why disapproval for Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. Just 28% of Americans approve, and that's down from 34% in January. It's even worse among young voters. Just 19% of Americans 18 to 34-year-olds approve of his handling. Now, meanwhile, in New York, Trump said this.
We're having protests all over. He was talking about Charlottesville. Charlottesville was a little peanut. And it was nothing compared, and the hate wasn't the kind of hate that you have here. This is tremendous hate.
Of course, that little peanut he's referring to is the 2017 white supremacist rally that led to a woman's death. And although there have been some confrontations with police and hundreds of arrests on the dozens of college campuses that have seen this uptick in demonstrations, so far there have not been reports of similar violence. Sabrina, you cover the White House for the Wall Street Journal. You've been covering this issue for some time. What are you learning about what's going inside the White House and how or whether the president plans to address these protests head on?
Well, you heard the White House condemn incidents of anti-Semitism that occurred at some of the protests at Columbia University. But at the same time, of course, they are supporting the right to free speech, the right to peaceful protests, and the majority of these protests have been peaceful. But what they can't ignore is the anger that is at the center of these protests over their continued approach to the Israel-Hamas war, specifically what has still been unconditional support by this administration for Israel. You know, these students calling for a ceasefire, wanting this administration to stop sending, you know, military and financial aid to Israel. And that policy isn't changing. So now they have to grapple with how do they address that frustration? How do they address that anger? What's also been striking is they haven't spoken out more forcefully about the way in which law enforcement has been weaponized by these university presidents and administrations to crack down on these protests. You know, videos of police officers violently throwing students and even faculty to the ground. Now, you know, college campuses are going to break for the summer. So I think a big question will be, does this kind of tamper down? But it does showcase, again, just how much this is an issue for the president when it comes to support from young voters going into his reelection
campaign. It's a great point about the summer, but then maybe it'll come back right back in the fall when they're back in session and back in school. But, you know, as we talk about the polling, the one thing that was interesting was from this Harvard youth poll this past week about the issues that concern 18 to 29-year-olds the most. Just 2%. Said that it was the Israel-Palestine conflict here, and compared to 27% on the economy. Clearly, that's the driving issue. And then the CNN poll gets a little further into this as well, talking about how just 38% of 18 to 34-year-olds are satisfied with their personal financial situation. Estead, you recently spoke with young voters for an episode of your podcast, The Run-Up. Do you think the Biden campaign truly understands the depth of their issue with young voters?
Yeah, I think it's an important question because the issue is kind of deeply rooted here. When we were focusing on what Next Gen America's polling was saying about 18 to 34-year-olds, it showed Joe Biden with just a 9-point lead over Donald Trump in a hypothetical matchup. It showed RF Kennedy polling 10 to 15% of people. And to your point, that wasn't all just about Israel and Gaza. A lot of these other issues are still top issues for people. We think about economy, abortion, democracy, but there are still some deep-rooted problems. Young people are not identifying with the Democratic Party in the same numbers. They, and specifically, are rejecting the kind of lesser of two evils argument that we hear the White House continuously to go back to. And you will hear the White House and Democrats say, well, this is just activists. You're really just thinking about a small group of young people when we look at these college protests. And I think that's important to point out. Not all young people have the same concern. But I would also say that activists matter. I mean, when we think back to 2020, it was those young activists who were creating a kind of permission structure for other young people to vote for Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. I mean, we think of 18 to 34-year-olds, they did not like Joe Biden in the last presidential primary. And they were kind of brought around to it in the end. And that was partially because there was a concerted effort by kind of people leading on social media, voices that matter in politics, to say, okay, there's a threat to, like, eventually back this guy over Donald Trump. Right. If those same voices are making the opposite argument going into 2024, I think that that can really be a shift in what the environment is around young voters. So I don't think they should dismiss activists, even though their concern should not be extrapolated to the young electorate.
I want you to, first, before you jump in, Caitlin, about just the Democratic hand-wringing about how the president should handle this. Listen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned about all the angst that we're seeing in college campuses and what this may mean for the president in November, especially as we're seeing uncommitted vote after state after state.
You know, this is not about politics. It's about doing what's right.
I hope they will give the president time to show that his leadership in the Middle East ultimately will prove out to be aligned with American values.
I think we've got to have an Israeli government that understands that the risk of escalation is really severe. And I do think the president has to be more direct publicly, not just privately, with Netanyahu.
So he's saying, I think the president should be more direct publicly, not just privately, with Netanyahu. Now, Biden's tone has changed a bit over time. So take a listen to how he's shifted a bit.
I'm sure innocents have been killed, and it's the price of waging a war. But I have no confidence in the number that the Palestinians are using.
the conduct of the response in the Gaza Strip has been over the top. They have a point. We need to get a lot more care into the Gaza. I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
What do you make?
That comment was very confusing to me because it wasn't clear what he was saying. It wasn't a very strong condemnation of what has been happening on these campuses. And a lot of it has been incredibly anti-Semitic. I mean, you can say that what's happening, you can differentiate what's happening. There is nuance here of the people who are protesting the war in Gaza. And it has been an incredibly motivating issue, understandably, for young voters. The comment there about, you know, I condemn the anti-Semitism, I think that's what and then in turn spurred Donald Trump to weigh in, which also confounded his advisors who weren't sure why he was bringing up Charlottesville, one of the weakest moments in his presidency. But overall on this issue and how the White House handles it, there were pretty significant protests outside the White House Correspondents' Dinner last night. I've never seen protesters outside, and it was specifically on this issue. I don't think Democrats have properly decided how Biden should best handle this and what is the best route for him to take. And I do think there are 6 months before the election. It could be an incredibly significant issue only in the margins. Maybe it's only 10,000 voters. That could have a real impact on the election.
And very quickly.
And that's just a really important point because, you know, when I talk to Democratic pollsters, what they say is if this is even the top or most motivating issue for 2 or 3% of voters in a state like Georgia, where young voters were, along with black voters, key to Biden's victory, that state was separated by about 11,000 votes. So it could actually make a difference if you're looking at a close race in some of these key battlegrounds. And yes, the majority of young voters, you know, you see a little bit more nuance in the polling, but with young voters who are Democrats, that's where you see the biggest drop off in the president's handling of this war. And that's a real problem.
Of course, we'll see if anything changes with the war as we get closer to November. Also a big impact as well. All right. Next, new reporting on whether Trump is an asset or a liability in some key Senate races. So how Trump. The parties are playing. Is that
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
The race for control of the United States Senate goes straight through red states with Democratic incumbents. In two main battlegrounds, Ohio and Montana, which Donald Trump carried twice, and where Democratic Senators Sherrod Brown and John Tester will need a significant amount of split-ticket voters to hang on to their seats. New this morning, Senate GOP officials tell me they plan to nationalize the races in those red states by going after Tester and Brown's past criticism of the former president. All in an effort to deny the Democrats' push to win over Trump voters. In other words, expect a heavy ad campaign promoting comments like these.
I don't have much use for Donald Trump. No surprise to this crowd. I think he's been a terrible president who's betrayed workers.
Some call him a racist, which I agree with.
You got to call it for what it is. It's racism. And quite frankly, it's dividing the country. That's how he hopes to win, I guess. And I don't think, even in states where Donald Trump won big, that it does you any good running away from Donald Trump. I think you need to go back and punch him in the face. I mean, the truth is this guy is bad for this country.
Meanwhile, top Senate Democrats tell me their focus, carpetbagging and character issues. They believe voters will judge the Democrats on their own unique brands and records, regardless of where they stand on Trump, as they try to poke holes and raise credibility questions about the GOP candidates in swing states across the country. My panel is back. So I put these questions directly to Brown and Tester this past week and asked them about their past criticism of Trump and whether they're concerned it could hurt them. Here's Sherrod Brown.
Just a quick question about Ohio. Just the fact that it's a Trump state and you were so critical of Trump.
Well, Trump won it.
Is that going to be hurtful? Your position on Trump going to be hurtful come November?
I do my job, and I'm not focused on the presidential, and we're ready. And I think it's clear I've won by good margins by standing up for Ohio workers.
And I caught up with John Tester, also a similar question to him.
You've been critical of him. You voted to convict him twice. Is that going to hurt you in your race? Your criticism of Trump, your votes against him. How are you going to win the Trump voter?
We're going to do everything we need to do to win. We're going to talk about everything that I've done for conservation and veterans and making sure this country is secure. And we've got a long, long list. A long list.
What is a Trump tester voter? I mean, someone who votes for you, voted for Trump.
Yeah.
But you've been critical of Trump. How do you bridge that?
Nobody's perfect 100% of the time.
He later said his aide is perfect 100% of the time we're walking with. Just to give viewers a reminder of what happened in those states. In Ohio, the 2018 Senate election results, 53-point, that's how close it was. Brown won against a different candidate in a different election cycle. It was not a presidential election cycle. John Tester much closer there. But Trump won those states pretty handedly. And the question here is, about split-ticket voters. Do they exist to a significant degree amid this very, very polarized electorate?
I mean, they exist in fewer and fewer numbers. And we know that when a lot of candidates say, oh, I'm going to take this out of the national race, I'm going to make this locally, we should have some skepticism about that. But with these two candidates specifically, I do think they have a good claim to that. You know, Sherrod Brown is someone who has proven consistently to have a kind of different type of electoral sauce in Ohio than a lot of other Democrats have had. John Tester certainly had that true in Montana. And, you know, as we go kind of around, I think there is space for Trump voters to be open to some criticisms of him. And there is an understanding, even among Republicans, that this is not a fully perfect candidate. And I think that's particularly true when there's issues of agreement that they can find with other Democrats elsewhere. And certainly Brown has made kind of economic, kind of worker empowerment part of his. I think you're going to see Democrats trying to make abortion part of that overlap too. And so I don't think that it's out of the question that they can pull some of this stuff off. But the reason Republicans are trying to nationalize this race is to just say that these areas are too red in general to overcome those personality differences. But, you know, I was just in Wisconsin, another place where they have a difficult time. And the number one thing that comes up with that Senate candidate, Eric Hovde, there, was the fact that he's from out of state.
Yeah.
Was the fact that he seems like a mismatch.
Carpet bagger,
100%. And so I'm saying there is a Republican candidate problem that they have on their own, even as they're trying to flip it on the Democrats.
And that's exactly the strategy. Democrats are trying to go race by race, candidate by candidate. They have a terrible map. They'll acknowledge it's a very uphill climb just because of the states where Democratic incumbents are trying to hang on, and red states that Trump won. And just to get a sense on the candidate by candidate, issue by issue, here's a sense of the ad campaigns that we're hearing in these key states.
Tester joined with President Biden and voted with the liberals again to help President Biden stop building the wall.
Another millionaire out-of-stater, Tim Sheehy's got no Montana roots and no idea what we're all about.
Sherrod stood up to the drug companies and capped the cost of insulin at $35 a month. He cares so much for the people of Ohio.
Last year, our daughter blessed our family with this cute little nugget. I'll fight for him and for your children to have a better future.
The strategy is pretty clear.
Yeah, and look, you have actually seen Democrats, especially in red states, pivot to the right on issues like immigration because of some of the pressure that they're feeling from Republicans on border security. But I do want to say, to Stead's point on ticket splitting, I mean, not only are Tester and Brown particularly popular in their home states, but we were talking about former President Trump's problems with Nikki Haley voters, the fact that in some of these Republican primaries, you know, he has still struggled to appeal to moderate or, you know, Republican-leaning independents. So that does show that there is still room for Democrats in red states to potentially prevail against, you know, these efforts to tie them to their criticism of former President Trump.
All right, we'll see how it plays out. Thank you, guys. Coming up, stay tuned for the best jokes from last night's White House Correspondents' Dinner. Last night here in Washington, journalists, politicians, and celebrities gathered for the annual tradition that is the White House Correspondents' Dinner to celebrate the importance of the free press. President Biden was there taking shots at his rival on the campaign trail, and no one was off limits for Saturday Night Live comedian Colin Jost.
Before I begin tonight, can we just acknowledge how refreshing it is to see a president of the United States at an event that doesn't begin with a bailiff saying, "All rise." The Republican candidate for president owes $500 million in fines for bank fraud and is currently spending his days farting himself awake during a porn star hush money trial, and the race is tied? I was excited to be up here on stage with President Biden tonight, mostly to see if I could figure out where Obama was pulling the strings from. It's also wonderful to be back in Washington. I love being in Washington. The last time I was in D.C., I left my cocaine at the White House. Luckily, the president was able to put it to good use for a State of the Union. I'm not saying both candidates are old, but you know Jimmy Carter is out there thinking, I could maybe win this thing. He's only 99.
But there were some serious moments from last night, including when the president called on Vladimir Putin to release Americans detained in Russia, including Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich.
Putin should release Evan and also immediately. Yes, we're doing everything we can. We're doing everything we can to bring home journalists.
That's it for Inside Politics Sunday. You can follow me on X at MK Raju and follow the show at Inside Politics. If you ever miss an episode, you can catch up wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Inside Politics. Up next, State of the Union with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. Dana's guests include Senators Lindsey Graham and Bernie Sanders, Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, and Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. Thanks again for sharing your Sunday morning with us. We'll see you next time.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.